Welcome to Info Nation, University of Illinois at Chicago's very own podcast, created by students for students. At Info Nation, we discover how media, information, and communication are created, governed, and used. Produced by upper-level students in the Department of Communication, Info Nation brings academic research to help make sense of our increasingly mediated society. We go to the library so you don't have to. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in. We've got a great show planned for you guys today about a topic that I think affects everyone, even though we might not think about it every day. Copyright. We have a few amazing guests for you today that were gracious enough to sit down with us. Thomas Levins, a law partner at Levins, Strand & Glover, who specializes in media, intellectual property, and entertainment law. We also will hear from Dr. Alexander Cummings, a professor from Georgia State University and author of Democracy of Sound, Music Piracy and the Remaking of American Copyright in the 20th Century. We also will hear from Bruno, an Atlanta-based mashup DJ and producer. We will get to them later on. I guess I'll get the cheesy line out of the way. Is copyright actually copy wrong? Now that that's out of the way, we can get started on the matter at hand. Before I get into the meat and potatoes of copyright, I want to preface by saying how important it is to shift our thinking away from arguing in favor of stealing and more towards the attitude of arguing in favor of creativity. Just keep that thought in the back of your head. In Carrie Ebel's This Is a Remix, Remixing Music Copyright to Better Protect Mashup Artists, she says, "The purpose of copyright law is to promote creativity and the desire to balance the interests of primary artists and secondary artists and to consider advances in technology." Consider advances in technology. So essentially, copyright law needs to keep up with the technology surrounding art, music, paintings, whatever it's trying to protect at the time. So what happens when the technology in music, or whatever media you're creating in, starts to outdate the copyright law? Thomas Levins, the lawyer I spoke about earlier, gave us his insight on it.
With the change of music recording and distribution and consumption in the digital area, essentially what you had is that there was a shift in control of music from the creators to consumers. Mm-hmm. Because consumers can do anything with music today that a record company can. Mm-hmm. They can duplicate it, they can distribute it, they can remix it, they can compile it, they can do any number of things. And that really had very, very significant, very big significance in determining what kind of values are going to be important with respect to approaching copyright law.
Thank you to Thomas Levins for that soundbite. Now, going off of that, let's take a look at the obvious, a big picture, per se. We all have access to the internet. What started off as a military project has blossomed into an almost never-ending library of knowledge, data, and art at our fingertips. We can share information in quite literally seconds. If I want to text a picture of my cat to Joe, I can and I will. Isn't it awesome that we can do that? Not just send stupid cat pictures, but we can use it to heighten our knowledge, use it to collaborate with another artist on the other side of the world. We can use it to find inspiration, or you can even use it if you're a scared parent when you find out your son is diagnosed with Asperger's. The options are literally endless. The internet, as we know it today, has evolved. It's called by many as by Web 2.0. Web 2.0 is the idea that we can configure our internet. Think of how you listen to music today. Streaming services such as Pandora, Spotify, or Last.fm all have different ways of giving you, the listener, the ability to choose what you want to listen to and how you want to listen to it. You can create your own playlists, you can choose exactly what artist you want to listen to, even when you want to listen to them. The idea of customizing, repurposing, and recreating is something that we have seen in human nature. Today, musicians call that remix, and it has birthed a sort of remix culture, where many feel they are entitled to create pieces of work that are birthed from other pieces of work. This entitlement, it reaches much more than just people who are wanting to create music. It's an entitlement that reaches the consumers and people who are actually buying music, not just creating music. Another point that Thomas Levins was able to touch on in our interview.
One of the big challenges is that one of the important consumer values that I think that is preeminent is comprehension. comprehensiveness of the content. The people want to have everything.
But I don't want to get ahead of myself. Let's take a step back and look at history, because copyright was not always the bad guy making it out to be. At first, it was created as an incentive to get people to create more. When Gutenberg invented the printing press, it opened the doors to the first way of distributing something on a massive level. One idea, one piece of work could literally be spread around the world and be looked at by other people, word for word. Naturally, some of the people whose work was being spread wanted to make sure they got their credit. Enter the Statute of Anne in 1710, what we now know today as the first real copyright law. It gave authors and creators exclusive rights to their work for up to 14 years before it went back to the public domain. The public domain is still very alive today, albeit a shrinking idea. It's a collection of works, art, and ideas that anyone is available to use without any fear of violating copyright. Basically, they can use it without getting permission or looking up laws regarding it. Now, why is this such a big issue today, as opposed to 20 years ago? Well, for a couple of reasons that I think are extremely interlinked. Let's look at music. Now, bear with me. What I am talking about right now is the idea of popular music, or to put it simply, whatever is making the most money at the time. Yes, there are exceptions to the rule, but right now this is the rule. It is important to note that a huge chunk of recording artists' income is coming from touring and performing live around the world. Record sales have almost taken a backseat. The days of being able to get rich off a number one record are dead now. Now, let's take a look at live music and music festivals. Rethink Music, a study from the Berklee School of Music, is quoted saying that total electronic dance music, or EDM, festival capacity in the United States has grown by a whopping 45% since 2007, while analog performer space has stayed the same. 45%. Let's try to give you guys a picture of that. The walk from one main stage to the other at Lollapalooza is about a mile apart from each other. Adding another 45% in size adds almost another half mile of space. In walking, that's about 10 more minutes, and that's just space for audience members. Get my point? What is drawing money is EDM, whether you like it or not. World-famous DJs are being thrust into rockstar status almost overnight. Simply put, that means music is changing. I've seen it firsthand working in the music industry. Traveling musicians don't need a huge van for all their gear, they need a backpack for their laptop. Seriously, look at how many DJ showcases there are at South by Southwest this past year, as opposed to 4 or 5 years ago. At a glance, for 2015, the number is at 94 DJ showcases, and that's only the official ones. The difference will be staggering between the years. I'm not saying instruments are dead. Absolutely not. I'm just trying to highlight the monumental shift in what kind of music is selling nowadays. With a shift in what is bringing money brings another huge shift of things such as selling and buying instruments. A turntable or a sampler, in many cases, can be cheaper than an array of guitars. Sonny Moore, which most people know as Skrillex, admitted that he made a Grammy-winning song with nothing but a laptop and a mouse in the back of a tour bus. It's shifting. It's a shifting, ever-changing world. So why hasn't the copyright law evolved with it? Dr. Alexander Cummings was able to give his insight regarding copyright law and the changing in music technology and culture.
The law has been sort of preemptively trying to lock down these developments in technology and culture, and I would say, from my point of view anyway, that the law has been too restrictive and too limited.
This is one of the biggest problems we are faced with. A shift in popular music and technology, but no shift in the copyright laws that control this flow of information. Dr. Alexander Cummings, who we just heard from, gave his opinion on the lack of evolution regarding the copyright law and the technology around it.
The music industry hasn't wanted to adapt. They don't want to. Like, they want things to be the way they were in 1985. Mm-hmm. And they want to promote an idea that, like, you know, I have copyright. I should get the maximum money for this, but we're in a different environment now.
So the question I want you to ask yourselves is why, and maybe more importantly, how, do we get the sudden stoppage in the evolution of copyright laws when the world and our culture is constantly evolving? What I mean to say is, how is it possible that the last major copyright revision was done in 1998, when we have almost completely changed how music is listened to, created, distributed, and remixed? Please keep asking yourself that, and if you come up with an answer, please enlighten me via email at nickasassi@gmail.com. To tie this all into a very current event, if you turned on any pop music radio station in 2013, it was almost impossible not to hear the smash hit Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke featuring Pharrell and T.I. Robin Thicke and Pharrell were in the news as of late because they are being forced to pay $7.2 million in damages to the estate of Marvin Gaye because they state that Blurred Lines sounds too similar to the song Gotta Give It Up by Marvin Gaye. And that is terrifying. The idea that artists can be fined after creating a song that may have a bit of a likeness? Spoiler, it barely does. No melodies or lyrics were taken from the original song Gotta Give It Up. Pharrell, Thicke, and T.I. said in a joint statement after the case, "While we respect the judicial process, we are extremely disappointed in the ruling made today, which sets a horrible precedent for music and creativity going forward." The case is currently expected to go to an appeal. Thomas Levins, the entertainment lawyer you heard from earlier, expects the verdict to be overruled during the appeal. He explains why.
That a lot of the elements that were identified as being similar in a way that created liability, those things are not copyrightable themselves. They're not part of the composition. This was not a case that was brought on the basis of a claim that a particular recording was infringed. They're saying that a particular composition was infringed. And to say that some of the sounds that were in the sound recording constituted elements of the composition that were infringed is a pretty big leap.
Dr. Alexander Cummings from Georgia State University tends to agree on the ridiculousness of this lawsuit. Thomas Levins was able to comment on what he thinks would happen if the court case was not overturned.
If this is something that holds up on appeal, then it's going to create, I think, a lot of re-examination about what kind of advice that we as attorneys give to people about what's permissible and what's not.
Now that I hope I have illustrated why this is a problem, I hope to shed some more information on why and how these copyright laws have overextended their reach, especially to creators, and why it is so hard to be able to tell artists what they can and cannot touch or draw inspiration from. Aram Sinreich, a professor at Rutgers and author of Mashed Up, Music, Technology, and the Rise of Configurable Culture, says, "Sampling should be called respiration, because it is the absorption, alteration, and exhalation of something external and ubiquitous." Think about this quote for a second. Really think about it. I'm going to try and simplify it with one sentence. Are you listening? Nothing. Absolutely nothing is created in a vacuum. Aram Sinreich is saying that the art of sampling is akin to respiration because it's something everyone does, conscious or not. You absorb oxygen, alter it within your body, and exhale it as carbon dioxide, and it is everywhere. This, simply put, is the same as sampling. When any idea is put forward by a creator, the idea will have pieces, or sometimes chunks of prior experiences, memories, and culturally processed memories. It's an idea that not only everyone participates in, but should accept with open arms. Think about it as a broader idea. Why are you the person you are today? Were you born like this? Or during the course of your life, did certain experiences and teachings shift the way you learn about different things? I argue that that is true. Personally, I don't have any skill at creating any of the music I feel so adamantly about, but I was able to sit down with Bruno, an Atlanta-based mashup DJ and producer, to shed some light on his thoughts. Bruno is a mashup artist, similar to Girl Talk, in which he cuts up and pastes different songs to create together a brand new song. It's like an extremely intricate collage made of different songs. Bruno, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to sit down with us. First, to kick us off, can you tell me how long you've been doing this Bruno project for?
I started back in 2007. I made just an album after hearing Girl Talk, and I just gave it off to all my friends. And then I think it was 2010 or 9 maybe, I decided to make another one. And then that's when I kind of went public with it and came up with the Bruno moniker.
Uh-huh. When you're creating your mashup songs or compositions or albums, do you ever see yourself as breaking any laws or doing anything wrong?
No. I mean, there's a law that says that we can essentially do this as long as we don't, like, profit from it monetarily. So, uh-huh. I mean, I don't see it as doing anything wrong.
And what drew you to creating these mashup songs as opposed to completely original compositions?
It's just something about this. It's fun. It's like a giant puzzle. And I got to put stuff together and figure out little tricky things that I like to do.
To tie this all into current events, I've been asking all my guests this just because I want to see where their minds are at, and especially I want to hear from you, a musician who's constantly creating music, especially sample-based music. What do you think about the recent court case regarding Robin Thicke and Pharrell and T.I. having to pay $7.2 million to the Marvin Gaye estate?
I think it's different. I don't think it's not copyright. I feel like Blurred Lines is inspired by that song.
Uh-huh.
The songs are similar, but they're not the same.
Uh-huh.
Marvin Gaye is trying to take Pharrell to court over Happy, and that song sounds nothing like it other than it's like upbeat.
Uh-huh.
It's just, it's ridiculous to me. there's a difference between sampled, ripped off, and inspired by it. Those are three completely different things.
Do you have any parting words regarding your music, your performing, your producing, in regards to the copyright law as they stand today? Is it affecting you? Is it going to hinder you at all? Do you even think about it at all?
No, man. I do it because I enjoy to do it. I mean, I've had a lot of people who want me to just go into original stuff, and it's not a matter of creativity or anything. It's a matter of I just like doing this.
Uh-huh.
It's intriguing to me, and it's fun.
Uh-huh.
And just if anything stays the way it does with like copyright, then I should be fine.
A huge thank you to Bruno for sitting down with us. I wanted to bring someone like Bruno on the show with us to give you guys an idea of what the thought process of someone who is constantly creating these mashups, especially when you have artists like Girl Talk being called a lawsuit waiting to happen by the New York Times, especially because I know not all of us are musicians. These mashup artists are popping up everywhere. People hear a few songs, and because they have a different upbringing or a different view of the song as the original artist, take it upon themselves to mash them up. For example, a subreddit by the name of /r/mashups has almost 70,000 subscribers. If you're not familiar with Reddit, it's a website that can aggregate all different things from different websites, and there can be different niche subreddits. For example, /r/mashups. The subreddit is filled with posts with requests for mashups, requests for assistance, and requests for reviews on their creations. These communities are slowly sprouting everywhere online. It's going to be hard when the copyrightists are in the minority. When peer-to-peer users are no longer seen as pirates or robbers is when we can begin to see a difference. These communities sprouting and becoming together as one create a constant battle for lawmakers. In Nancy Baim's Rethinking the Music Industry, she says, "Music audiences use online tools to pool effect, create social identities, collect intelligence, share interpretations, and create for each other. The real challenge for the industry, recession or boom, is to work with, rather than against, these dynamics. We need an alternative. We need a major overhaul in copyright law as we see it, or at least maybe people seeing it in a different light." Lawrence Lessig, an extremely prominent scholar, has been extremely busy implementing and promoting the use of Creative Commons in all pieces of art published online. Although, this wouldn't be an overhaul. It would just be a certain change in the licensing between creative arts. The vision behind Creative Commons is simple. And I quote, "Realizing the full potential of the internet, universal access to research and education, full participation in culture, to drive a new era of development, growth, and productivity." That's a quote from the Creative Commons website. Doesn't that sound appealing to you? By using Creative Commons, you can choose to give up the copyright, all rights reserved, that is automatically placed on anything you create, and open it up to use from anyone, as long as they credit you, of course, and don't make money from it. You aren't hoarding these ideas or creations for yourself, but rather sending them out into the world in hopes that other creators do something with it, maybe something you never thought of. I think this is the future. Here's an excerpt from Creative Commons regarding how exactly Creative Commons helps. Here's a video produced by Creative Commons explaining exactly how Creative Commons can be used by creators to make sure that their works are protected, but also open to use by other artists.
When something is created, say a photo, a document, or a music track, it's automatically protected by copyright. Copyright enables people to say who can share and reuse their creations. You must always obtain someone's permission before sharing or reusing their work, even when it's posted online. But what if a creator wants everyone to use their work, without the hassle of granting permission over and over? This is where Creative Commons can help. Creative Commons provides licensing tools that are free to use. You can apply a license to your work, which refines your copyright and streamlines how you give permission.
I hope they were able to explain Creative Commons more eloquently than I would ever be able to. I was lucky enough to ask Dr. Alexander Cummings his opinion of the Creative Commons and the things Creative Commons can bring to creators.
So I think that Creative Commons is actually a really good adaptation, I think, of the system, because there are people who don't mind their work being reproduced, and they don't want other people to feel inhibited by copyright law from, you know, in terms of like reproducing it. So I think this is a really powerful movement. I think we've really seen in the last 15 years or the last 10 years, like, people actually, like, speak up and say, we want to counter the pro-copyright, pro-music industry, pro-movie industry sort of legacy position. And I think that's been really healthy.
So, there you have it, folks. Is Creative Commons finally the huge step in the right direction we need to push policymakers and copyrightists toward a different path? Toward a path that can be able to create a more free-flowing culture? Only time will tell. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We hope we were able to shed a light on a subject that otherwise may have been dark to you. We want you to be able to look at copyright, or any social matter, and create a social discourse that everyone can be involved in. How and why do the lawmakers get to decide what artists get to create and how they create it? And more importantly, why are we using outdated copyright laws in an age where technology is thriving? Again, I want to give a shout out and a huge thank you to our guests, Thomas Levins, Dr. Alexander Cummings, and Bruno. And another huge thank you to Lawrence Lessig and the entire and all the work he's been doing with Creative Commons. Have a great day, everybody, and we hope you learned something today. Thank you so much for listening to us today. Again, we are Info Nation, coming to you from the University of Illinois Chicago's Department of Communication. We hope we piqued your interest and you learned something new today. Please feel free to engage by rating, commenting, or sharing our episodes. Have a great rest of your day.